It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Have you been out in the cold weather recently and seen a cyclist go by? It seems impossible, but Alaskans are using their bikes year-round these days and leading the country with new technology to make cycling a year-round sport for transportation, racing, and expeditions. We have guests in the studio who do all those things today, some great adventures to discuss, and we'll get into tips that can make winter biking fun as well as daunting and extreme. And my three guests are pretty much all bikers that are way beyond anything that I would do, and way beyond anything I would do. Billy Koch, is that how you say it, Billy?
Yes.
Yeah, he's an adventurer, expeditionist, guide, and I did a bike racer who... And we are going to talk about this quite a bit. He cycled from the Iditarod Trail to Nome, and then turned around and cycled the Iron Dog Trail to Fairbanks, all in one trip. Amazing. Yep. Thanks for being with us. And John Lackey, who's with the Arctic Bicycle Club. He's been with us before to talk about mountain biking, and now into the season of winter mountain bike racing.
Yep. The season's here.
And the season's here. And like, it's cold enough now, right?
Absolutely.
And Rose Austin sells bikes and is a writer, has written about biking, and is a bike commuter here in Anchorage in the wintertime.
That's true. Thanks, Charles.
But you do have your limits.
I do have my limits. Days like Wednesday, where it's 18 below near my house, I'm maybe not going to commute.
Uh-huh. But pretty much the rest of the year, all the time?
But the rest of the year, I'll commute quite a bit. Week or so ago when we had that freezing rain, I thought, you know, I trust my bike more than I trust most of the cars, so I'll go that way. And I had a great ride.
Mm-hmm. So you're riding a bike with studded tires, obviously.
I'm riding my fat tire bike with studded tires so I can go through soft snow and icy trails and streets and feel really safe.
Uh-huh. Now let's talk the fat. Do you call them fat tire bikes? Do you call them fat bikes? What's the correct terminology?
I think everybody's
struggling.
There's a million different names.
Yeah. For a while, people were just calling them snow bikes, mm-hmm. and fat bike was a name that was used by one of the early manufacturers, one of the early designers up in Palmer. Yeah. But fat tire bike has become the name because it takes us from just the snow riding to some of the other things people do on them. For example, mm-hmm. beach riding, mm-hmm. Sand, rock trails.
People figure out you can do way more with a bike than anybody ever imagined.
It's not just a snow bike.
All right. Mm-hmm. So if anybody out there hasn't seen one, we have lots of pictures on the website at alaskapublic.org. There's a movie with Billy, and there's some pictures of bikes that are ready for expeditions and racing. Rose, you sell these things. What makes a fat bike or a fat tire bike? The distinguishing characteristic is a very wide wheel.
Sure, and the standard has changed over the years. I remember years ago, I thought 44 millimeter rims were huge, mm-hmm. and they did make a difference. But then we migrated to rims that are up to 80 millimeters, which is the most common size, I think, these days. And now people are even running 100 millimeter rims,
which
so think 4-inch wide rims.
Yeah.
And that's getting pretty large. The challenge is developing a bike frame with the crank arms that can go around that frame.
Mm-hmm. Because you can't just have a regular bike. Obviously, the fork wouldn't be wide enough, and the chain would run into the tire.
Right.
Okay. So, John, you guys are racing these bikes. Is that sort of a new phenomenon, or
relatively? The history of it with the expedition races like the Iditarod Trail and the Idita Sport, that's been around for 30 years where mm-hmm. guys have been essentially riding mountain bikes along the frozen rivers.
Or pushing them
right, for, a lot of the time. but the most recent development, I suppose, is the more cross-country style races, the shorter races that have turned into more of like a mountain bike, a little bit more accessible to your average user. Mm-hmm. Instead of having, a four-day long, essentially, expedition race, now it's an hour and a half long. You go out there, race, and then you go home and get warm.
Yeah, and you have a series, right?
Yeah, and there's a series in town, the Abominable Snow Series, and Will Ross is the guy that runs that. And it's essentially like a regular mountain bike series, but just in the snow.
So what makes racing on a fat tire bike, what are some of the differences from racing in the summertime on a mountain bike?
The traction and the conditions are, it makes a way bigger difference. When it's soft snow, you're thinking about your tire pressure constantly. You know, am I running too soft a tire pressure, too hard? Do I have the right tires? Do I have the right tread? It amplifies that aspect of the riding. You know, you have to really think about what you're doing with your equipment. When the snow conditions change even just a little bit. And then otherwise, it's just a little different. It's a little slower, but you're still going pretty good, and you just have to... The trails change. They definitely evolve. Like, every time it snows, the trails are a completely different trail system. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool.
Right. So when I see people in the summertime out on the single-track trails at Kincaid and stuff, I'll see people sort of hot-dogging, flying up in the air, doing tricks, running around logs. Do you guys do that on the fat tire bikes too? It doesn't seem like
not as much. Yeah. It's usually a bit slower. Although when it gets hard packed, you can kind of do some of that stuff. Certainly not as much as in the summer, but you can do it.
All right. So Billy, I teased everybody that we were going to talk about this expedition, and then we got into the commuting and the racing, this had to be a really, really difficult expedition. You all the way from Willow to Nome, then Nome to Fairbanks, and I guess your bike weighed 170 pounds or something.
No. When I got to Fairbanks and we're putting it on the plane, obviously with no fuel or whatnot, it was 120 pounds, and I didn't really believe them because I never wanted to weigh it or didn't even want to think about how much the bike weighed before.
That article in the Newsminer said something about
So I went in and actually saw it. Era, it's like, oh yeah, that's 120 pounds. Crazy. So I had to get a photo of that when it was on the scale.
And that was after you'd used up all the fuel and the food that were on it before.
They wouldn't allow it on the plane, so I couldn't have the fuel on it. So,
but if we were going to say how much did it really weigh, it was 120 plus.
Yeah.
So that must mean a lot of pushing, frankly, right?
Most years, certainly. I was blessed with a low snow year in the interior. Very rare certain years they've had it, but really I don't know if I could have kept going with my toes that I lost the previous year if it wasn't a low interior snow year.
So, and how many miles? Like 2,000?
It was exactly 1942. Okay. That's what I did.
And how many days did that take you?
A little over 40 days.
Wow. So 40 days outdoor camping in the middle of Alaska. Yeah. Give us a day. Like you wake up in your tent, but completely by yourself, completely unsupported, and think, oh boy, I want to go biking today.
It is. You're really thinking on your own. Like before you stop, you can't just stop on your bicycle. You can get hypothermic real quick. So before you stop, even before the thought of, hey, I got like 5 miles, I'm going to stop, you really need to think, okay, what tasks am I going to do first before I, stop? You know, what first am I going to do? You know, you got to really concentrate on your hands, your body heat. You don't want to escape. You want to throw on a jacket or get all the frost off of you immediately when you stop.
Because even when it's cold out, if you're working that hard, you're producing a lot of perspiration and energy.
Certainly, yeah, nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
Your thermostat's going constantly. You're frosting and, thawing out, all the time.
Mm-hmm. How did you learn all that stuff?
Over the years, I did a sport, which is the race that pretty much brought about all of our fat bikes and the creation of all this, modification of the modern mountain bike back in the 90s. And it's trial and error. Okay, I failed this. What can I do about it? Mm-hmm. This worked. What can I do? And I actually stopped. After 1999, I'd done the first Extreme to McGrath, I've done the second year, and 1999, I made it about, 40 miles, and I looked around and I said, I've pushed a lot of years, and I'm just not going to do this anymore. So
the skiers are flying by you.
I took about 4 years off. All my friends are developing these fat bikes, and I got on it, and it was like, oh, it was night and day. It's like I can actually ride a lot more than, we were literally riding on normal mountain bikes, and the fat bikes changed.
Which you never could have done the Iron Dog ride trip on a regular bike, right?
You could, but it would have been a lot more difficult. I certainly probably would have walked
easy,
it.
Right?
Yeah.
So I was getting you to tell me a little bit about, so you wake up, your day is constantly thinking about the temperature. That's sort of the main thing that's always on your mind, is keeping your body protected from the cold.
And water. Constantly, you need to understand fluids are the most important thing when you're out there to keep you going, to keep your food intake. If you stop drinking, you're going to stop eating, your body's going to shut down, et cetera. So your morning when you wake up, it's instantly I basically have a water bottle that I heated up the night before. You go to bed with that. You know, that's your little heat source. Makes you feel, you know, warm and yummy. Mm-hmm. But then you have a starter for the next morning to thaw your 200 ounces of water. You know, you need a lot of water. And that's in, you know, on your back, on your water bottle cage, et cetera. Then food intake and pretty much knowing the trail conditions, putting your air pressure, if the night before was really warm, your low air pressure in the morning, it's hard. Mm-hmm. You need to pump up all your air pressure and get ready for the mm-hmm. next day.
So a lot of mental work as well as physical work involved in a trip like that.
Oh, probably 70% mental. Yeah. Like physical will happen if you really have
if you force yourself in
fortitude to go, yeah.
All right, it's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about fat bikes or fat tire bikes today, those big bikes with the up to four inch wide tires that you see running around that float on top of the snow and allow people to do things that we could never do before. And this is an Alaskan invention that is now spreading across the country and across the world. I was in upstate New York this fall and went into a bike shop, and there was one of these bikes way up on the wall, and the guys in the shop were obviously super cyclists, were saying, oh yeah, I'm going to try that this winter, you know, and oh yeah, we've seen that before. So another one of these cool things that Alaskans are pioneering. Three guests in the studio today. You just heard from Billy Koich, who, as you heard, rode across Alaska both ways last year. John Lackey is with the Arctic Bicycle Club, and Rose Austin is an author, cyclist, and works at Paramount Cycles. And I just wanted to get into the bike itself. Rose talked a little bit earlier about what makes it different, just the fat tire. But what was the experience for each of you guys like when you first got on one of these things and found out what you could do? Rose, do you want to start that one?
Wow. Well, I had made the move over to the 44 millimeter rims a few years before from a standard, you know, mountain bikes had rims about 20 to 23 millimeters wide. And when I made the move to those, I thought, wow, I can ride on so much more. And so when I finally made the switch to a fat tire bike, it was again that wow factor. And I would equate it to that first time you get on a wider ski. And you realize how much more control you have. And so being able to pedal through 4 or 5 inches of snow without that front wheel going wiggly on you just made a huge difference for me.
Does it float just like a ski, basically, on top of the snow?
It's somewhat
depends.
Like that.
Yeah.
It's somewhat like that. You have different snow conditions. You also have to know, you have, is there a good base under it? The first few snowfalls of the season, you're still dealing with a little bit of the tussocks that are out there. Because the snow bike allows you to ride on different terrain. Winter riding, you can ride places that are iced over. So there is a little bit of that float, but you're not on top of the snow. You are pushing, you know, compressing it as you go.
Yeah. John, how did it change your cycling when you first discovered these things?
Well, it allowed me to ride in the winter. I had moved up here, and this was 5 years ago about, and I was still riding a regular mountain bike. The whole first winter, I'd go out on the multi-use trails on my mountain bike, and I'd see the guys on their fat bikes and be like, man, that looks fun. I could only go out after the groomer had come by and packed it in and people had walked on it. And so the next year I went and talked to the guys at the bike shop and borrowed a bike from them, and it was night and day. It's just like, oh my gosh, I can ride any day, anytime, anywhere. This is great. So, you know, I'd go out and do, you know, 2 hour rides after work and hit all the small trails and pack them in, and it's pretty cool.
I guess you can't really ride through powder, or maybe you can.
It depends how deep. You know, if it's just a few inches and you've got a good base, like Rose said, you can ride through it no problem. When it gets a little bit more wet, like mashed potatoes, and too deep, then it gets a little tough. But you know, the super light powder with the base underneath it, you can slog your way through it pretty easily, actually.
Billy, it sounds like in the Adidas Sport, you were a biker all the way along, even when the skiers and the snowshoers were flying by you on the way out there.
Certainly.
So was that I could just always imagine that must be very frustrating to be in a race and you're like on the wrong on the wrong piece of equipment.
Yeah, I mean, I never was a skier. I just, you know, pretty much, you know, grew up as a kid and saw the four guys that came up to Nome for the first time. You're a 14-year-old kid. It set such of an impression in me that it was just like, they can come, you know, you see dog musher, and then you're like a cyclist. The four guys just came up on 1,000 miles, you know, it was kind of clicked. And then
that
it
needs to be me, huh?
It went further. Yeah. I moved to Fairbanks 2 years later, started working all weather sports where they invented the snowcat that Rose was talking about. So, I mean, pretty much, I was like the first kid that got pushed right into this stuff, you know, like the kids are nowadays watching the fat bikes go by and running to the bike shop. I was actually working at the bike shop that they were inventing and developing these wheels for the snow and the idea of the sport race.
Wow, tell us about that. Like, how, I mean, some obviously I can see the motivation. I mean, you could look at the bike and say, wow, this could be made better. But somebody then has to go out to a machine shop and start making the pieces. That's pretty challenging.
It was really neat to see these guys way back when in the late 80s were actually taking a normal tire that had really low profile, but they would take like tubular, which is a road bike. Basically, you glue your road bike tube on, and they're flat repair. They have this little like thread and needle, and they're threading, they're cutting tires apart and sewing them up, you know, on two snowcats that they're welding together because they're already welding multiple wheels together. And we had at one point in time like a 5.5-inch wide front end and, you know, a snowcat with a 2.5-inch wide rear, but it was so much more superior because your front end would give you the trail for the rear. So, you know, a decade earlier, we were actually developing this. And then they made actual bikes that had two tires in the front, two in the rear, then the three tires in the front, three in the rear. So it was really neat just to see that all around you and everybody coming in and say, hey, Simon, hey, look, you know, here's the new thing. And, you know, it was really neat. It was great that he came out with that 44 millimeter wide wheel because then all of us had a little bit, I guess it was a lot easier for us to ride in the harsh conditions.
And it sounds like competition was a huge part of this, you know, that everybody wanted to be able to do these wintertime races and that sort of driving it, where it might not have if you're just a tinker. Rose, do you?
Yeah, I think the racing, as with so many other sports, it does drive the innovation and the improvements, whether it's a fatter tire, whether it's a lighter weight tire or a lighter weight frame. But that doesn't mean that the average rider would not benefit from all of those things.
Sure.
So when you have so much innovation and so many new products coming out, people who never thought about winter riding are now getting on winter bikes and realizing how much fun it is and how it doesn't seem as crazy as it did 10 years ago.
It seems much more normal. Yeah, what's happened to our brains? So there's an article that I threw up on the website at alaskapublic.org, which was a Craig Medred article from the Daily News back in 2006, and he talks about Mark Groenewald building maybe the first what we would recognize today as being a fat tire bike. And do you guys know him?
Yeah, I remember meeting Mark in the late 90s. He brought one of his early prototype, Wildfire was the name of his company. He brought one of his Wildfire bikes to the shop. Unfortunately, Mark's pretty tall, and I could barely fit on the bike, but I admit that at the time I was a little skeptical, but then a couple of friends got them and just started saying, this is it. And so Mark was really one of those people who helped start this revolution of biking here. There are other people who were building in Alaska before him, but I think he tried to do more production.
It sounds from the article like he's the guy who maybe figured out how to put it all together into sort of a bike that you would buy in a shop rather than one that people are putting together in the backyard.
Yeah, he was definitely instrumental on, you know, pushing this to the next level. And all of his racers, everybody was trying to help out with, you know, him also. There'd be a racer say, hey, can we do this? And, you know, they're really neat to see, you know, to be there, you know, actually watching it all unfold. It was neat, you know, him and John Evenson actually found the wheels and tires in a Vegas bike show in the 90s. And Evenson just, you know, he makes his own bikes and everything out of his garage. It's great. And he mocked up the first one, and they were trying to design, because the original bike that the manufacturer had would crab, basically, to try to make the rear end actually work so he can shift. So these guys came up with an offset design so you can actually use a normal hub.
Huh. So this may be hard for people to visualize, but when you say crab, so it would start to turn sideways down the trail, or?
No, so like your bicycle, you want the front end and the rear end to be symmetrical in a straight line. So basically the original bikes were crabbed off to one side, so definitely like turning, and it didn't ride
just so that they could line up the chain. Because that's kind of the challenge. Is
chain
the
chain, exactly, chain for shifting, and, right, you know, right. So you can ride. You need definitely a lot of gears to ride in the deeper snow or with the wider wheels and tires, et cetera.
So, Billy, what kind of bike do you ride? And is it? It sounds like you got a new bike after you finished the. You rode from Willow to Nome to Fairbanks, and then you said, "I need a new bike."
No, it's in 2009. You know, like I said, I was telling you earlier, it's trial and error. It's. You know, you get out there and you just failed attempts. Well, you're stuck in your head for hours and hours and days. So I came up with in 2009 a quick break apart bicycle. So I know the only way I'm going to do this, not have the runners and skiers, everybody pass me, is to have a sled system. So that bicycle was custom designed for long distance, et cetera, so I could break it apart. So I was kind of like, all right, I did my ride.
So in other
ride.
Words, you can't ride anymore. You can break down the bike, throw it in a sled, and pull it.
Yep.
That way you don't have to walk it. Oh, good idea.
It breaks in half with couplers. So now I was like, well, I don't really need that. I wanted just a normal mountain bike. Mm-hmm. So I purchased I'm a commuter, so I just got a new titanium fatback. And with the sliding dropouts, because I was commuting, I use single speed. So it's just easier on drivetrain, et cetera.
Okay. What do you use, John?
I've got the exact same setup, actually. Titanium fatback with the slider dropouts. I use it single speed mostly, but when I race, I'll put 10 speeds on the rear, and so I'm a 1x10.
Okay.
So, great bike.
And why that arrangement? That seems odd.
I like the single speed just purely because I think it's fun. It's enjoyable to ride. I like the simplicity of it just for riding. But when you're racing, it's, you know, you kind of need the gears if you want to keep up with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty simple swap over for me. I can switch it from a single speed to a 10 speed bike in 15 or 20 minutes without a whole lot of trouble.
It must be a pretty big sprocket with 10 gears on it.
Yeah, that's an industry standard these days. Everything's 10 speed. They're going to 11 now. But yeah, you get a good wide gear range unless you're doing something really steep or really long. You don't need much more than that 1x10. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
What are you riding, Rose?
I'm riding a Salsa Muckluck, but I found out I'm getting a different bike. Somebody thinks I should have a different bike for Christmas. He knows that I know now. So and I'm going to move to a full carbon frame and fork from Borealis. So it's a new company that was started by a couple of people who are from Alaska and a person in Colorado. And that bike is what I like about this one. I'm going to run a 2x10 drivetrain instead of the three gears in front that I have right now. So it simplifies the drivetrain, kind of like what they're talking about. And then it offers internal cable routing, so your cables aren't out there as much. Mm-hmm. And it'll allow me to, it's one of those carbon bikes that allows you to put a rear rack on it, because when I'm going on my rides, whether it's commuting or doing a little adventure ride, I want to carry some extra gear with me, like a warm coat, food, you know, a warm drink if it's a day-long adventure ride. So I'm moving to a different bike this winter, and I'm pretty excited. And what I like about that carbon material is it is a very lightweight, but also carbon to the touch is not cold. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people will use carbon handlebar because it's not taking that heat away from your hands the way aluminum or steel or titanium would. So it's kind of a movement we're seeing now in the bike industry, is the move toward carbon.
Cool. I know we're going to want to talk a lot more about technology and all that stuff, and also how to stay warm, because that's always a big issue with winter biking. But but before we go to the break, Rose, you sell these bikes. How much? I mean, we've got people are out Christmas shopping as they're listening right now. They could turn the wheel and say, go in a bike shop, but they. Well, what kind of price does it cost to get one of these bikes? These are pretty high end.
Well, the carbon bikes are definitely going to be in the higher end of the spectrum, but you can get into a really nice quality aluminum bike for just under $2,000, and then upgrade things as you go. Mm-hmm. So, for example, drilling out the rims to make them lighter. So people don't have to spend a fortune. And when I look at it, for people who mountain bike in the summer and they might spend $2,000 on a full suspension mountain bike, we have a pretty long snow season here. So it's definitely affordable to people who do want
people
to
are serious
mountain
about
bike.
It. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 2000 is basically an entry bike in terms of a fat bike.
Kind of a step up.
Okay.
And then up to 6,000 and higher for the what we call a dream build.
And is the main cost factor just that it's a small production run type item?
And it's the specific components that are needed, the wider bottom bracket for the crank arms, the wider hubs, the wider rims. So there is some of that. Economies of scale is not quite happening yet with the snow bikes, but it is definitely more affordable than it was 10 years ago to get the level of bike we're talking about today.
But the bikes are in mass production, so you can walk into a bike shop and buy one right now.
Oh, yeah. All the bike shops in town have piles of them right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. There you go, folks.
Fat bike capital of the world.
It is the fat bike capital of the world. And thus, maybe Fairbanks is fighting for that. We'll see.
Nah.
No.
All right. Challenge. Yeah.
Well, obviously, a really fun topic, and we hope you're enjoying it. It's Outdoor Explorer. Rose Austin was just talking. She's a writer. She's with Paramount Cycles. John Lackey with the Arctic Bicycle Club, and Billy Koich, who's got too many different credits for me to mention, but he's an amazing adventurer on his bike. Lots more to talk about in the second half. How do you stay warm when you're biking, and kind of what are the limits? What are the reasonable limits? Or maybe there's no limits. And what about people who are switching over from skiing to biking? I'm hearing a lot about that. So we will be back with more right after the Outdoor Explorer calendar. There'll be a solstice torchlight skate tomorrow night, Friday, December 20th, in Anchorage. This holiday skating party will be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Cuddy Midtown Park Skating Oval and Pond. Holiday lights and torches, music, and free horse-drawn sleigh rides. Celebrate the solstice and the holidays at the Cuddy Park Solstice Torchlight Skate. Take a fat tire bike for a spin on solstice, Saturday, September 21st. Valley Mountain Bikers and Hikers is teaming up with Arctic Cycles to bring their rental fleet of fat tire bikes to the valley for some winter biking on the Moose Meadows Winter Trail System in Palmer. This is a great opportunity to ride a fat tire bike for a day and find out what it's like to roll across the snowy landscape. For more info and to reserve your spot, go to vmbah.org. The 2013 Willow Winter Solstice Marathon, Half Marathon, and 5K is this Saturday, December 21. The race begins at Willow Community Center, winding through Willow Area Lakes and on to Red Shirt Lake in Nancy Lake. Registration deadline is 8:30 a.m. the morning of the race. Snowshoes and spiked shoes are allowed, and you may need them, and you may also freeze. For more information on the 2013 Willow Winter Solstice Marathon, go to willowrunningcompany.com. And it is exciting to see how much stuff is happening this winter. Alaska is such an exciting place to live. And finally, coming up at the end of the month, the Mattsu Ski Club is hosting the inaugural Mattsu Icicle Double, a two-day ski event. To tell us more about it, we have with us by phone Dave Musgrave from the Mattsu Ski Club. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you doing, Charles?
I'm doing great. So a new race. What are you guys doing?
Well, as you probably know, we just got our new ski trails in here up at the Government Peak Recreation Area, and we're trying to feature our first big race the weekend after Christmas, and it's the Mattsu Icicle Double, and it's 2 days. It's both Saturday and Sunday. Saturday will be our classic ski, so you have to do diagonal skiing there. And then Sunday will be freestyle, so you can skate or diagonal, your choice.
All right. And what's the distance?
Well, that's the thing. It's a lot of distances. You can pick whatever you want, all the way from 2.5 kilometers, 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers, and 30 kilometers each day.
Wow.
And you can sign up for one or both races.
So you could do 30K back-to-back on 2 days, and then you just
could.
Collapse.
So it's quite the challenge, yeah. So it's quite a challenging... The 30K will be quite challenging, but for those people who just want to go out and enjoy it, there's shorter races for you to enter.
Mm-hmm. And this is the trail there is about 5 kilometers, or how long is the Government Peak Trail?
Well, we have 7.5 kilometers of trails out here, but we'll be using two loops on them, which will give us a total of 5K. So if you're doing 30 kilometers, you're going to be doing 6 laps.
All right. And how's the sign-up work? Where do folks sign up for the race?
Well, you can sign up at our website. It'll take you right to the sign-up for it. And go to www. You have to put the www in.
Okay.
Matsuski.org. And go to the competition tab there. And the first thing you see will be Matsu Icicle Double.
All right. And what's the fee?
The fee is $30 for one day or $50 for both. And if one parent participates, all kids under 13 are free. So we're trying to promote this as a family event, so make it nice and cheap for full families to come out and enjoy long distances and short distances. If you feel like you need to burn off some of that Christmas ham, then you can do the 30K. If you want to get out there and do a little speed work, you can do 2.5K. Your choice.
Okay, cool. So each family member can ski their own distance, and then I'll be done at the same time, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you can choose your distance. You can change your distance. You sign up for one on Saturday and say, well, I did 30K yesterday. I'm not going to make it. I'm only going to do the 5K. You can change right up to within a half hour of each race.
Any goodies you're giving away?
Yeah, we are. We have a wonderful one-pint beverage. Some people think it's a beer glass, but it's actually a beverage glass.
Right.
And it'll be engraved with, it'll have etched in there our Matsu Icicle Double logo on it. And we hope to make this a collector's item and have it in the future for the Matsu Icicle Double past the inaugural race.
That's a great idea. We all have plenty of hats, so it's a good idea to have a beer glass. Oh, I mean a beverage glass.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for being with us, Dave, with the Matsu Ski Club. And we'll have a link to the Matsu Icicle Double on our website, as well as all the other events we mentioned today on the Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Thank you, Charles.
Stay with us for the second half of the show when we'll continue to talk about winter biking when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking about winter biking today, particularly about these big fat tire bikes with the great big balloon tires that allow you to kind of float on the snow that previously you wouldn't have been able to ride on. It's an Alaskan invention, and it's spreading all across the country, but I bet there's nowhere that they're doing as much as they're doing it here. And I've got three experts in the studio, Rose Austin, who's a rider and sells bikes at Paramount Cycles, John Lackey with the Arctic Bicycle Club, and Billy Koich, who's a data biker, you rent bikes, you're a guide, and biked from Willow to Nome and then back to Fairbanks, by the way. So I want to talk about clothing. My winter biking, I've enjoyed. I don't have a fat tire bike yet. I have studs on my regular bike, and I'm a very avid skier, so when there's enough snow for skiing, I kind of want to ski. But when it's icy, spring and fall, or when the snow isn't great, I'd love biking with my studs. But it's really hard to keep for me to keep my toes warm, and so that's an issue. And using a lot of foot warmers, and I know a lot of people have trouble with their hands. I don't have that problem as much. But I wanted to go through each of you because you're each experts. You know, expeditions, racing, commuting. I know you all know about all those topics, but I thought we'd start with you, Billy. When you're out in the middle of Alaska and it's way below zero, how do you keep, what do you wear? I mean, especially those issues with the feet and the hands.
I'd probably recommend what most people use. Mine is a more custom footwear, but Neos work really good. It's an overboot that you can put around like a running shoe or whatnot. and it's you can basically lash it down to your existing shoe, and that gives you a vapor barrier and also gives you enough room so you can put a heater pack, like an 8-hour heater pack, to keep like I say, my creature comfort, so I can stay warm. And heater packs definitely work a lot.
So which, as in those ones that they sell at Costco in a box?
The chemical heater packs, yep. Mm-hmm. Really good. And the 8-hour ones, you know, the Hotties are probably one of the best brands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, and so in your almost 2,000 mile ride, did you just take a whole bunch of those along?
I had set up so I could use 8 a day. And sometimes I really wanted a lot more.
I imagine. So did you have have them sent out to the villages to pick up on the way, or how did you handle
with
that?
With my custom boots, I actually have them shoved on the inside of more of a liner on the sides of like a pocket system that I have on the side of my over boots.
I see. Cool.
So it was, you know, storage. It just, you know, I thought of almost every way I could to store and package stuff. They're flat, so you can put literally probably 10 per shoe.
Wow.
And then I've got inside of my sleeping system was all my, you know, food replenished and everything. So each day when I get up in the morning, I'd, you know, shove which, you know, how many I need on the side of my boots, so they're easily right there where you need them, et cetera. So.
Well, but you had to be resupplied on this trip, right? Or did you didn't haul everything?
No, I did not. The post offices, it was, you know, I'd usually about 150 or 100 plus miles, I'd get a resupply in Alaska. Sometimes it gets there and sometimes it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. So face, what do you do about your face?
Oh, that's a great question. No fog. I stress to everybody, like we're out at 18 below. I do group rides on Mondays. It's called Mellow Monday Rides, just depending on where in town, just to kind of get familiar with the trails for new people and me too. You know, new trails are being made all the time. But a no fog mask was developed in the 90s for snow machiners. So they can basically, it's got like a snorkel that goes below a helmet. And so your fog, your goggles or glasses or anything doesn't fog up. But we can use them skiing or biking, and they're great. You can get them at most snowmobile shops. And there's several different brands, but No Fog is the original brand.
All right. Are you kind of making sure every inch of skin is covered?
Certainly, yeah. I definitely have got frost nip over the years, and I don't have to worry about it at all.
John, what about when you're racing for an hour or two, then you are presumably producing a lot of body heat. How do you keep a good balance?
Yeah,
you
know, that's,
what do you wear?
It's always a challenge. I mean, you're actually getting quite warm, so I'm wearing a lot less than I would think that I would have to wear. You know, you go out there and if you're racing in a short race, gosh, you can almost wear just tights and a light coat. And you're going to be, you know, soaked in sweat at the end, and you're going to be hot. And then as soon as you stop, you're just going to freeze.
But you,
can jump into the car and
and that's the same with ski racing, except that to me, it seems like my hands and feet are much more vulnerable when I'm biking than when I'm skiing.
Yeah, and the two things that help on the hands and the feet, I guess starting with the feet, there's a couple of different companies making really well-insulated clipless boots that you can actually clip into your pedal with. There's a company called 45 North that makes a very well insulated, almost like a mountaineering style boot that has that cleat on the bottom that you can use. That's actually what I have. And when it gets really cold, I cover it with a neoprene liner, like Billy was saying. And then there's also Lake that has been making these winter boots for a long time. But those are they're great for racing just because you have that option to have the clipless pedals and stay warm. And then for your hands, the pogies, the bar pogies, which are essentially giant mittens that fit over your handlebars that you slide your hands into, and you can put a small liner glove on your hand and slide it into those pogies, and those stay amazingly warm. The key to those is
it's passive though, right? There's no chemical heater in there or anything like that.
No, there's no chemical heater, but you can, I mean, these are big expansive mittens, so like your hands can float around in there. You can store food, you can store extra coats, or you can store chemical heaters if it gets really cold. The one tip that I have about the pogies is just to make sure that you have a very good closure on the handlebar so that no wind comes through, even just a little bit, and your pinkies will start to freeze or your thumbs will start to freeze. And
you guys can both all weigh in on this, but I mean, the factor that makes your fingers and your feet be so vulnerable is because of all that metal, right? Because the metal is kind of sucking the heat out of your body. Is that true?
Right. And Rose spoke to this earlier, and that people are going to carbon handlebars more and more, and that's another great point. If you can do a carbon handlebar, it's a little bit more expensive, but it's well worth it because that heat transfer is just so much less through the carbon.
Mm-hmm. So Rose, what do you wear for commuting? What's your rig?
My setup is I have the handlebar pogies on my bike, and these pogies come in different weights, and that's a pretty good description. I mean, they're like big mittens or like a little sleeping bag for your hands. So I use those, and they're waterproof also. So if it's freezing rain, you're good. For shoes, for the last year or so, I've been using. If it's really wet out, I'll sometimes ride in my bog boots, which are waterproof. But I do have some of the Lake winter cycling shoes for those times where I want to use my clipless pedals. Because one mistake a lot of people make is they forget about their feet, and they'll go out riding using their summer clipless pedals. And the big problem there is this metal taking the heat away, because mm-hmm. there's such little space. There's no insulation between the foot and that metal cleat that attaches to the metal pedal. So you definitely get some frozen foot that way. And I'll use a lightweight glove. If it's really cold out, I'll use a wool felted mitten over my liner glove because it's very warm. And it's something I can wash easily, because a lot of winter gear, it gets pretty nasty if you do a lot of sweating in it. Mm-hmm. But wool is pretty good for that. The other thing that I like to do is if I'm doing a ride with friends, and I think this is a critical part, because what Billy is doing, he's doing long distance events where it's solo, it's his pace, and John is doing racing where it's his pace. But for so many people just getting into winter cycling, they're going out on these group rides where people have different body temperature comfort levels. Mm-hmm. They ride at different paces. They might have to stop for a mechanical or stop to wait for a rider. So it's so critical that when people are doing group rides, that they bring that down coat, that they mm-hmm. bring maybe an extra pair of pants, that they bring
hand warmers. You need a bike that can carry that can carry some cargo, so you have all the backups. Mm-hmm.
Just a backpack.
Or at least a backpack. Yeah. Or what's really popular these days are these frame bags, which are also made locally. Mm-hmm. And the frame bags fit into the triangle of the frame, so people will stow, like a down jacket can compress pretty small, just so you have that emergency equipment. The other thing I go for is I use a lot of wool base layers, mm-hmm. and I layer my gear, so I might have a couple different layers on so I can change if the conditions are different. If I'm climbing into the Chugach State Park, climbing up to Glen Alps, I'm getting pretty warm, but when it's time to turn around and come down, mm-hmm. I want to have that wind jacket so I don't freeze.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Windblock materials are really important too.
So you guys all commute sometimes on bike? Yeah.
Yep.
So how do you deal with the issue? And this is a summer as well as a winter issue, but when you get to work, you got to look like you're ready to work. And when you are, you know, in the summer, it could be just an issue of being wet or being sweaty. But in the winter, you've got like multiple layers and all this stuff. How do you, let's just go around. Rose, how do you deal with it?
Well,
of course, you work in a bike shop. So.
Well, I think, but I still want to be presentable. Uh-huh. The key is leaving clothes there. So I'll have mm-hmm. a change of clothes at work. I'll also, you know, for many years, I've told the person who cuts my hair, make sure it looks good after I take my helmet off.
Right.
So, you know, you're really not, it's really not as bad as people think. But I think having a change of warm, dry clothes is really helpful. Yeah. If I have to carry my clothes in my backpack and then change into those clothes at work, I'm going to be cold for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Billy?
Same thing. I'm fortunate to work for the state of Alaska. We've got a nice locker room and showers, et cetera, and really fortunate that the guys, my bosses, understand that, wow, it just snowed 2 feet. He might be a little late today.
Uh-huh.
So, and they give me a little extra time, but being a surveyor, working outside all the time, we definitely use the locker rooms a lot and into some pretty nasty stuff and surveying in swamps, et cetera. So
yeah.
I'm fortunate to have that already in my office.
Sounds like you've gotten the right career for your
adventuring.
Yeah. John, how do you handle that issue of getting to work and looking presentable?
Well, my commute's pretty short. It's about a 3/4 of a mile, so mm-hmm. it's not pretty a easy. Huge problem. But, you know, in the winter, it's actually a bit easier because I can just layer over my work clothes and then mm-hmm. ride in.
And ride easy.
Yeah, so, ride easy, exactly. Yeah. Moderate the pace so you're not sweating, you know, mm-hmm. not just soaked when you get into work. And at that point, I have an extra pair of shoes at the desk and I just change into them and I'm ready for the day.
Yeah. So it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. That was John Lackey with the Arctic Bicycle Club, and Billy Koich is a rents bikes, is a guide, and has done some amazing adventures across the state. And Rose Austin, an author, and sells bikes at Paramount Cycles. I wanted to talk to all of you guys about introducing people to the sport. And, you know, the bikes are obviously expensive, and there's a lot of gear involved. And I think there's probably a certain amount of trepidation about what it's like to go out there where it's really cold. Billy, it sounds like you've introduced a lot of people to it. What are some tips or advice you give, or how do you go about doing that?
Over the years, like with Valley Mountain Bikers and Hikers, I've grouped up with a lot of the organizations in town. And my business started with the idea of the sport just as a rental and guides business. But it's pretty much gone to the masses now. It's great. Everybody comes in town and knows, oh, go rent a bike from Billy. And, you know, you just go, or I do like a solstice ride. I do usually the New Year's Eve ride and just bring a lot of people out and really show them the little basics that we need to know, like air pressure, et cetera. There's one common occurrence that's happened lately on a kind of catastrophic failure. But a lot of us in Alaska, we don't there's like on your tubes, the new tubes, they have removable valve cores like a car, which is, you know, great in the lower 48 because our fat bikes, they have thorns and rocks, et cetera, that'll puncture our tires. In Alaska, we certainly don't want that core to remove. So you'll get out there and start teaching everybody air pressure. And a lot of people got new bikes and they unscrew their, you know, to loosen or let some air out. And the core is in a field of white. And
oh my gosh. Yeah.
So, just one thing to look at, you know, definitely make sure if you do have that, just take a little like wrench or not wrench or like pliers and just tighten up that core a little bit. Should be fine. But
do these tires take a long time to pump up?
Certainly, depending on the temperature. Yes.
So the colder it is, the longer it takes?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
And you want a big pump. You don't want one of those little guys.
Road high volume pump. You know, road pump is just good if it says road. The other thing you really want to make sure is they have plastic end caps. Is what I do is usually get an extra, like a plastic O-ring or whatever, and just put it on and tighten the plastic cap on. Because the problem is, as soon as you pull your lever to actually tighten that valve or tighten the pump onto your valve, it'll break that plastic off the front of it, and then you basically can't air up your tire. But if you put like even a little piece of tape or whatever so that plastic cap doesn't seat completely, then you won't usually have that problem. But or just buy a pump that has an aluminum head is really good for winter.
Right. It seems like if you're there'd be a lot of mechanical things like that that would be issues in cold weather. Things that can snap, things that don't
absolutely.
Work.
Absolutely. You got to look into the materials that you use. And like Billy said, the plastic on the pump can fail very easily when it's minus 30. But yeah. So
are these bikes being designed so that they have fewer issues? I mean, I know you mentioned the cables being inside the frame. Does that like keep them from getting frozen up as much and stuff?
Right. Having the cables go inside the frame, or what people will do who don't have that option, they'll do what we call a full cable housing. So we'll have housing that goes all the way from the lever to the mechanism, whether it's the brake or the derailleur. And that way there's no open area for water to get in, because when we have changes in the temperature and we get rain one day, if you're riding and get water inside, then next time you ride when it's cold, that water's still in there and it might freeze, and then you don't have the ability to change your gears. So doing
what about the pneumatic you know, the shifters and brakes that use the pneumatic,
the hydraulic,
you know, hydraulic, is that to be avoided in wintertime, or is it okay?
It work.
Yeah,
it depends on the brake. So some of the brakes use a DOT fluid, which is not affected by the cold. Some of them use a mineral oil, which can be affected by the cold. And I think sometimes there's discussion about whether that's the seals or the oil itself. But just to be on the safe side, I usually recommend using one that's a DOT fluid.
So in other words, a hydraulic fluid that you would use in a vehicle
in a car.
Something. Yeah. And And I didn't get your response to introducing new people to the sport, Rose. Did you want to weigh in on that one? You're talking to new people coming and saying, gee, do I want to buy this bike or not?
Sure. Well, a lot of times I send people to Billy.
Okay.
And so we have his number on hand. We say, you know, try one out. For a while, we tried at the shop, we were trying to do a demo program, but we haven't been able to keep enough bikes in stock to do that. But the first step is, I mean, when people come in looking for a snow bike, they've probably already talked to somebody about it. They have an idea that they've seen it looks cool, they want to do it. So yes, we will send people to Billy for a rental. And then once they get the bike, I do think it's helpful to go on some of the group rides, because the trails in the winter are not only different conditions, but there are also different places where we can ride. And the only way to learn those trails is by going with a group. So even at the shop, a couple people do a weekly ride, and they call it Paramount on Snow. And those rides, we advertise them as being no-drop rides, which means we're not preparing you for racing. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a person in the front and a person in the back, and people can learn the trails, and they get an idea of how to take care of their bikes, how to deal with tire pressure, like what Billy was just talking about. So I think that's a really good way to learn the trails. And those are all night rides, which is even a unique experience for most people
And I want to get into lighting in just a minute, but I want to give John an opportunity to talk about people who, you know, they're doing it and they think they might want to race. And anything you need to know or strategies or issues about wintertime mountain bike racing, which is a rather specialized field.
It's a fairly specialized thing. Once you understand the, you know, fixing a flat and tire pressure and the nuances of just biking in the wintertime, you're pretty well prepared to race. I mean, if you know how to race a mountain bike, it's essentially the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get into the longer, ultra races, the 100 miles, the 350 miles, then you got to start thinking about gear and thinking about all the little things that you have to do to keep your hands warm for that long mm-hmm. of a time period. But, you know, the ones that are just in town, you just come out, and if you can ride a snow bike, you can ride these races. It's not
What are the distances on these abominable snow races?
They usually go 1 to 3 laps, and the laps are in the neighborhood of 4 or 5 miles. So, you know, it'll be, I suppose the longest would probably be 15. Although I think that the one at Eagle River is a bit longer. I think it's a 25-mile race, something like that.
Are you mostly using single track or roads, or what's the setting?
A little of both. We'll do single track and some on the Maltese trails. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of both. The single track's tough because once you get a big group of people on there, it's tough to pass. So you want to kind of mix it up, and they do a pretty good job with that, getting, you know, some of the Maltese trails involved. So then you have a wide corridor that people can pass and you know, the race can break up and
So tell me about what the field is. I'm suspecting you're a pretty good athlete, but folks who might want to get involved in this might think, maybe I'm not good enough, it might be too intimidating. Do you get people out there who just kind of want to test themselves in a race and they don't have to
absolutely.
Be super athletic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's from the best bikers in town to just folks that are just ride around. I mean, there's three categories. You've got a beginner, an intermediate, and an expert category. And so the beginner category is, you know, that's a not super competitive category, and it's people just out having fun and, you know, wanting to test out the racing thing. And so you just do one lap, and it's, you know, it's certainly not a super fast group, and they're out just having fun. It's actually really fun to see those guys afterwards because, you know, they just had a great time and worked hard, and it's a great camaraderie, and it's a pretty fun time, actually.
Yeah, sounds like me in a ski race, being back there, just trying to get back before, like, they shut down the whole thing and everybody leaves.
And they finish the cookies.
Yeah, no. The cookies are gone, this drawing is over, and I'm like, hey, is anybody still here? So I imagine conditions would be even more important than in summertime racing, that thinking about how hard is the snow and like, positioning yourself in the race and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Absolutely. It can go from, you know, the hard packed or even icy conditions all the way to the super soft, you know, deep powder where you're essentially pushing your bike the whole time. And we've had everything in between. So, mm-hmm. you know, if it's icy, you're going to want studs. You're going to even need studs. And the races around town don't actually limit you to requiring a fat tire bike. So there's been a couple times where I've raced my mountain bike with studs on it just because it's a faster bike for the job, you know. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, icy hard packed trails, so there's no need for the float, just want the traction.
Right. So with Outdoor Explorer, we're running out of time on this fascinating topic, but I want to make sure to draw everybody's attention to the website where Billy has a video up. We've got a bunch of links talking about his amazing journey that he did last winter from Willow to Nome to Fairbanks. Then links to the Arctic Bicycle Club, the Abominable Snow Series bike races we were just talking about, Did a Sport and the Ultra Sport. Rose has a personal blog and is also involved in Alaska Dirt Divas. And we also have a link to Billy's business, Arctic Cycles, where you can rent a fat tire bike and get involved in the sport. I'd like to talk about lighting, and then I'd like each of you to talk about some cool adventures very, very briefly, because we don't have too much time. We've got this neat picture on Facebook of Rose in front of Knik Glacier, which glacier and biking together, cool. The new lights you can get on a bike, Rose, are like super bright. I mean, they're like something on a car.
Yes.
And
I'm mixed on that.
Yeah.
I think that in, you know, a lot of these lights are designed for lower 48 where there is no snow to mm-hmm. reflect the light back.
So you don't feel you need that much light?
I don't use that much light. I definitely go for the lower level light rather than the overkill. And for people commuting, I recommend putting the light on their helmet mm-hmm. because on the helmet we can turn to see that driver or even shine it right at the driver yeah. so they see it. So
I've
they
actually
see
been
the
using
intersection.
Two, one on mm-hmm. the handlebars, one on the back, and one on my helmet.
Yeah, yep. definitely yep. a flashing taillight. And that makes you street legal. I mean, the law mm-hmm. is helmet, white light in front, red in back.
It must be a challenge on a long trek because the batteries would go dead, right?
Yeah, certainly. I've been experimenting for years with hub generators. A couple of good German companies, and actually I brought a prototype for our fat bikes on my 2,000-mile trek. Schmidt Sun is the company, and now they have an actual 135 hub generator for us. The lumens aren't as great, like you're saying, mm-hmm. as bright as some of the other lights out there, but it'll give you everything you need and more, and actually you don't need any batteries. So
yeah, and those batteries will die real quick if you don't keep them warm, in some way. So the detachable battery pack can be positive. So, Rose, you have to tell us about this picture where you're in front of the glacier, just in the short time we have left.
Yeah, well, that was a couple of years ago. I went out to Knik Glacier with my husband and a couple of friends, and we were in this deep, overcast day, a pretty chilly day. And I posted a couple pictures on Facebook, and another friend said, I want to go there. So I went out there with one of my friends now that I figured out the route. And there are some safety considerations for mm-hmm. river and glacier travel
question.
I can't really cover here. But the experience of being that close to the glacier and you can see the uplift that's happening on the lake surface from the glacier moving forward is just a fantastic experience. And what I love about winter cycling from an adventurer standpoint is I can go places I can't go in the summer.
Yeah, it's a great sport. You guys have totally got me thinking I was going to buy backcountry skis, but now I think I'm going to buy a bike. Too many things to do in Alaska. It's such an awesome place to live. I want to thank my guests. You just were just hearing from Rose Austin, who, as I said, a blogger and author and sells bikes at Paramount Cycles. Billy Koich, the amazing adventurer, has Arctic Cycles as his business, done these long journeys. Thanks for being with us, both of you. And John Lackey, Arctic Bicycle Club, helps put on races and do a lot of stuff in the community. So we're going to take next week off for Christmas, Kristen and I. But thanks for joining us. We'll see you in the new year. Kristen Platt is our producer. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.